Today is Sunday, April 25th, 2021. This is part 11 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Haggart, spelled last name H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Tom. Looking forward to chatting.
Great. May we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you may.
Thank you very much. Jim, last time you told us about a really wonderful backpack in the spring of 1996 into Nankoweap, and it was a really nice recounting of that. And after that backpack, then what did you do?
Yeah, so, you know, I think we've talked earlier and in the past couple of sessions about how, you know, you do these trips and you start them and you're not necessarily in the best of shape. And of course, by the end, you're just going like gangbusters. So after we finished this trip, which was I think about 8 days in Nankoweap, we had some extra time. Of course, I was living in Canada then, so I had to get back up here. But we had a couple of extra days, and so I proposed that we just do a day hike. The same guys, Art and Bruce and I. We stayed over in Flagstaff at Bruce and Dewart's house. And then I said, let's try going down Papago, because I'd heard that Harvey Butchert had found a route down there, not recently, but, you know, sometime prior.
Right.
And Papago is along the south rim between Desert View and Coconino,
right.
Coronado Butte,
in
about in the middle of that area. And the reason I wanted to go down Papago was, of course, number one, to explore the descent, right? And I know that you are interested as a red wall climber in putting roots through the red wall, and particularly with connecting from rim to river, right?
Right.
So making those connections is always pretty cool.
And yes.
Quite often you'll encounter First Nations artifacts along the way because they were doing the same thing.
Absolutely.
We were doing, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so in 1970, I think it was 75, January of 75, I had done a backpack trip. This was early on, but I had gone from Tanner Trail over to Hans Canyon.
Okay.
With a friend of my girlfriend at the time. So this was my girlfriend's pen pal from Australia.
Okay.
And her name was Sue Merritt, I think it was. Anyways, the three of us had done a backpack trip together. My girlfriend Sharon, and then her friend Sue, and then I think Doug Rickard might have been involved in that too. Anyways, we had done a backpack trip from along the Tonto from Hermit to Bass to Bright Angel.
Okay.
And so this lady from Australia, you know, had never she'd never kind of seen anything like this before, and so she was really interested in the Grand Canyon, and I said, well, look, why don't you and I, since we've got some time, do a trip from Tanner to Red Canyon? And so she said okay, and then my girlfriend at the time and this woman were planning to go to Mexico for a month trip. So Sharon, my girlfriend, went back to Phoenix to plan that. And then I did this trip with Sue. And of course, you know, there's a route along the river much of the way. And but one towards the end of the trip, I had stopped with Sue and at the mouth of Papago. And and I said, okay, look, give me an hour while I, you know, run up and see how far I can get up Papago. And so she said, okay. And so I started up as fast as I could and made it up through the Precambrian there, which is spectacular, you know, the geology. And there's a really neat, I remember this really fantastic climb, like 150 feet up this buttress with just huge jugs on it, you know. And so anyways, I managed to get to the top of the Tonto at that time and then ran back down. Oh, no, that's right. I followed the Tonto around into Red Canyon, went down the trail, and then went back up river. So by the time I got back, it was much more than an hour or two, you know, that I had promised. It was like more like four.
Right.
But she was pretty cool with it, you know. I don't recall, anyways. She probably was thinking this guy's a real jerk. But anyways, so I had wanted to connect, of course, right, with
right.
that climb out of Papago
right.
to the rim. And so I suggested this to Bruce and Art in '96, and they said, yeah, that sounds great, you know, great trip. So we started down, and it's a, you know, very kind of loose. I remember a very loose descent through the Kaibab gullies, and then you have to contour along a little bit to the north, and then there was a break down through the Coconino. It's very loose in there too, and then you slowly descend and down. And as we're going down through the red wall, or on a slope down to the top of the red wall, Bruce stepped right over a coiled rattlesnake sitting there in the sun. I guess it was still early enough in the morning that it was groggy, right? Because he missed it completely, and Art, following him, found it, and basically, you know, the three of us kind of gathered around and looked at it. But, you know, no, it's not an uncommon experience, right? But so then we worked our way down through the red wall there, a nice little third-class climb, and those guys waited for me while I ran down and connected. So I had, you know, another line on my map from rim to river. So that was pretty, it was a nice ending to the week we'd spent in Nankoweap, you know,
and
do that
is,
day hike.
Oh, Papago Point, this is just north of the Tusayan Pueblo, isn't it?
Yeah, and actually it's to the northwest. Yeah.
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 And there's
so,
a ton of arc sites in there. So I'm assuming that route would have been a heavily used route down into the canyon, or certainly could have been used. I don't know if it was used a lot, but there it is, right at that location. So it's kind of interesting.
Oh yeah, I think you're right, and I don't recall actually, you know, finding artifacts along that route in particular. We may have, but I don't recall it. But I do remember thinking that the route through the Kaibab and Coconino was really loose. You had to be very careful. So I got the sense that it was not something that would be a trade route, you know,
yep.
that you'd have kids and elders, you know, running up and down,
like
you know,
the
easily.
Tanner might have been easier.
Yeah. But nonetheless, I'm sure that these routes, you know, virtually all these routes that we find were pioneered by by First Nations people, you know, and yeah, and so, but and that's kind of the one of the mystiques, right? When you're going down, you can imagine what it was like, you know, 800 years ago or more, and that reminds me, you know, one of the very incredible experience I had, emotional experience, was that trip I told you about into Nankoweap with my uncle in the mid 70s, my
right.
uncle from Dallas, John Nelson, and John had wanted to go up to the granaries, right? The granaries above Nankoweap Delta.
That's right.
Famous spot. I mean, pretty much everybody on every river trip has to go up there, and so we were down there. There's nobody there in the time of year we were there, which was really nice, and we hiked up there, and I was, you know, we're just sitting there relaxing, taking the photographs, and I'm looking at the mud of the adobe, you know, on the structures there, and I can see these fingerprints, you know, and palm prints, and I'm thinking to myself, my God, you know, I could almost, you know, if we'd had fingerprint analysis in the Anasazi culture, I could know who my brother here was that had preceded me up here 1,000 years before,
right?
You know what I mean?
Right.
It was just so cool to see that. You know, impression in the adobe, and be able to connect on a real personal level with the people who actually built that structure.
Right.
You know,
right.
So I'm sure I'm not the first person that's ever experienced that. Any, you know, I mean, it's probably a very common phenomenon, but it is kind of a neat experience when you do have that, and you put yourself in perspective. You know, your position, your place as a visitor in the canyon. You're just one of many, many thousands of people over thousands of years. So different way to look at it. So anyway,
down,
that was
so down to connect up your line on Papago, and then did you guys turn around and just work your way right back up again?
Yeah, we just kind of had a relaxing afternoon. It's like one of these day hikes, you know. I'm sure, you know, we were in such great shape after the extended backpack that it was not really much of a challenge, you know, to get back out. But that was it, just kind of relaxing and taking it easy, you know.
Nice.
So, yeah. So I wanted to tell you about the next trip I took, which was also in 96. Well, a couple more trips. But there was this, in the middle of the summer, I went down to Arizona, and I don't know now exactly why I was there in the middle of the summer, because, mm-hmm. You know, I don't normally visit there when it's July and in Phoenix. But I was down there, and I asked my mother, who I would have been staying with, if I could borrow her car and go up to the North Rim, and because I wanted to just see, you know, to do some short hikes, and she said, you know, sure, no problem. And so, you know, you may recall, I think that had we done Sigley? I can't remember now, but there's the Atoko Point route, which I talked about some weeks ago, which I went down one year late in the day to try and connect with Doug Ricard and his boat party on the river,
right.
in downstream from the mouth of Quoggin.
Right.
And so I had been down this route, and of course this is a budget route, so no news there. And I wanted to go out and look at Siegfried Pyre and what some people were calling Little Siegfried, which is an unnamed butte to the northwest of Siegfried Pyre. And also this butte that was out to the northeast of Siegfried, which is also unnamed. And I thought that would be a nice little trip to do, you know, as some climbs on these two unnamed buttes.
Mm-hmm.
And in a short kind of, you know, couple day overnight off the North Rim. And I was figuring, because it was the North Rim, fairly high elevation, it wouldn't be too demanding in July to go down to that level, right? So anyways, I organized the trip and drove up to the North Rim, and I believe I got a permit for this one because I was going to be parking on the road, right? And or just off of it,
right?
And with my mother's car, and I didn't want to have it towed away or anything like that. So I get out of my car where I park it near the road there. So this would have been just a couple, well, on the road on the plateau, Walhalla Plateau,
right.
Near where it passes west of Atoko Point. And so I get out of the car, get my backpack together. I change from my sandals into my hiking boots, right? I had these lightweight, I don't know what brand they were, some sort of lightweight hiking boot. And at that time, I had just taken up wearing orthotics. And so I had worn my orthotics down to Phoenix on the plane or, you know, in my normal shoes. And then when I drove up to the rim, I put on sandals and I left my shoes at home at my mom's house. And, of course, because I was planning to put the orthotics from the shoes into my hiking boots,
right.
There were no orthotics in the hiking boots. So I pull out my hiking boots and prepare to put and take my feet out of my sandals and slip my feet into my hiking boots, and they're very loose, right? And it's just like stepping onto a piece of wood or something like that.
Huh.
When you put your foot in there, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? And so, you know, I was really kind of disappointed. But then I thought, well, how bad can it be to hike, you know, without an insole in your boot for a day and a half or 2 days? And so I said, I resolved to try it. I said, I'm not going to let this ruin the hike, you know. I'm going to go down with no insole. I'll just wear an extra pair of socks and see what we can do, right? So that's what I did. I worked my way down and through the brush there. And, of course, when I had gone down there the first time, I didn't know the route at all, and this would have been when I went down in the mid-70s to visit with the Ricard trip.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember at that time having to fight a tremendous amount of manzanita and brush, and it was very fatiguing. So, but this time I stayed high right up at the base of the Coconino after you get down off the rim. And it was beautiful deer trails, you know, right at the juncture of the cliff and the slope.
Yeah.
And sometimes overhangs of rock, but really open and nice deer trail. And you could just whip through there, you know, and make really good time. So it was fun to find that on this descent, because I knew that it would be much quicker going out or in future visits now that I knew to stay high there, right?
Hmm.
And that's a general lesson I learned
for
hiking anywhere in the canyon, you know, is to stay as close to that basal Coconino cliff as you can, because you're typically going to get some clear space there to walk. So, so then I hiked down and followed the below the Coconino there, and then eventually got down to the Redwall Saddle. I'm sorry, the Supai Saddle between Etoko Point and Siegfried Pyre.
Hmm.
And that's where I camped for the night. And my feet were sore. You know, by this time, my feet were really sore.
Mm.
And but there wasn't much I could do because I was already down there.
Right.
And so I resolved not to let it, you know, bother me and carry on. So the next morning, I went up and I ran up this thing called Little Siegfried, just another small, I believe it's a small Coconino Butte. It could be Supai, but I think it's got a little bit of Coconino on it. And from there, I could see Butchered Butte. Of course, it wasn't named that at the time. It was just this really impressive-looking butte out on the ridge, projects out on the ridge of Supai, like a mile beyond most of the high-elevation Coconino Buttes in that part of Grand Canyon. And you know, you can see Butchered Butte from the road at the base, from the highway 89A at the base of the Vermilion Cliffs. You can see Butchered Butte at one point along that stretch of road.
Cool.
And you can also see Butchered Butte from many places on the southeast rim drive, right? Desert view. There's great views to the north, and Butchered Butte just stands out on this ridge. So I thought this was a really neat summit, and I didn't know anything about it, so I went out to it and hiked out and then climbed up the chute, a gully on the southeast side, and I remember it being a real fun sporting climb. I had to leave my walking stick down below because it was steep enough, you know, that that it required both hands and both feet and a little bit of not really route finding, but definitely keeping track of your holes, because it was, you know, steep enough that there could have been a problem if something happened there. And I get to the top, and initially I thought, oh wow, cool, I don't see any cairn or anything, so I might be the first recorded ascent, right? But then I poked around and I found a couple of rocks piled, and it was obvious that somebody had done that, right?
Right.
Who, I didn't know, because there was no register, but I did leave, I checked my notes on this earlier today, and I did leave my name in a film can, so, you know, it's up there somewhere, hopefully.
Cool. Yeah.
And, but at this point, you know, I started thinking, this is a really neat peak, and, you know, I'm surprised it doesn't have a name, because it's so prominent. You see it from so many places, but I guess, you know, now that I think about it, you don't see it a lot necessarily from down below. And maybe that's why it wasn't given a name, you know, by the surveyors.
Right.
In any event, it was out there, and it was a lot of fun to have done the climb, and then, you know, succeed at that. So I worked my way back to that campsite, and then I figured, well, I'm going to go out since my feet are, you know, reasonably in shape here. I thought I'd go out. There's a route that goes down through the Kaibab and Coconino to the south, of Atoka Point and farther south from the Hartman Natural Bridge in Lava Canyon. And so it's about a mile or so north of what's called Naji Point, N-A-J-I Point. And this is another budget route, so it's nothing new, but certainly new for me. And so I poked around over there, and it was pretty hot, in the afternoon, early evening sunshine. And I, for July, I was getting pretty fatigued. And I remember I got into the Coconino Gully there, and it was not a very straightforward climb the way I went up. And but probably that was a function of the heat, I'm thinking, more than anything else, and the soreness of my feet, because that was that was stressing my legs, the constant pounding on my soles was really fatiguing me. And in any event, I remember getting to the top of the Coconino and doing some dicey climbing, where I felt pretty apprehensive. I had to haul my pack at one point, and I got to the top of the Coconino, and there was a little tiny bench, on a ridge of the slope there, just above the top of the Coconino, and I could put my sleeping bag down flat. I put my mattress down first. I'm not even sure if I had a sleeping bag, because sometimes back then, at that period, I sometimes just carried a sheet when I was hiking in the summer. But I lay down on the mattress and immediately fell asleep. I was so exhausted. Eventually, woke up, had something to eat, went back to sleep, and then in the morning, finished the climb up to the rim and back to my mom's car. So, that was a kind of a memorable trip for the basic boneheaded error of leaving your hiking shoes behind, or at least the part of them that's fairly important, and then of course doing that summit, and at that time, of course, Butchered Butte didn't have a name, and so it started percolating in my mind that this would be a neat way to honor Harvey Butchered. And I'm not sure exactly when Harvey died. Do you remember the year?
I don't.
Yeah, something tells me 99, but that may be too late. In any event, it might have been mid-90s. So I'm not sure Harvey had passed away at this point or not, but I was thinking that in the future this would be something that could be followed up on. So eventually I did that, I can't recall exactly what year again that Harvey passed away, but I went onto the Board of Geographic Names website, and it basically said that you can name features after people, but only after they've been deceased for a certain number of years. I believe it was 5 years. And so right after I'd done this climb, I started looking at the timing. I think it was something like 99 was going to be the eligible a year, so maybe he had passed away in 94, 95, something like that.
Right, they have to be deceased before the name can be considered.
Yeah, so I started, putting together a proposal to submit to the Board of Geographic Names, and I mean, if you want, I can look up the exact dates for this, and we can amend the discussion later, I guess. Certainly I put together the proposal, and I sent it in, and there's a fair amount of paperwork that you have to go, and it goes into number of committees. It's examined first by the Park Service, and then it's examined by the proposal is examined by the county. Coconino County then would have reviewed it, and then I think the state of Arizona, and then each of those groups, my understanding is, had a First Nations representative on there, who also would have been involved in this. And so the initial response I got from the Park Service was, thank you for I shouldn't say from the Park Service, but I sent the application into the Board of Geographic Names. And they came back and they said, we have sent this on to the Park Service, and they're very concerned because they have a policy of not naming features in wilderness areas anymore. So at that time, the area below, you know, off of the highway, I guess, on the Walhalla Plateau Highway, had been designated wilderness of some sort, and therefore, to name a feature below the rim would be violating this, I guess it was an informal guideline, right?
It's that's a really good point. So Grand Canyon National Park doesn't have congressionally designated wilderness, but the Park Service has to manage it as potential wilderness until Congress decides. So they have to manage it as if Congress has said yes. They can't go build highways and cut down trees and that kind of stuff. They have to wait on the pleasure of Congress to take this up.
Okay, well then that's exactly the problem, the dilemma that we had, you know. And so I thought, oh boy, this is complicated, you know. And of course, at this point, you know, once you get an idea in your head like this, you really want to push it through, you know. Mm. And so I just kept pushing and pushing and calling people and getting names of people and you know, writing additional letters of support. And there were a couple of other individuals who also wrote in support of the nomination, like Art Christensen. And I remember I was looking through some magazine like National Geographic. It wasn't even National Geographic. It was some like Newsweek or something. And there was an ad for an insurance company or something like that. And there was a picture of somebody sitting on the rim of Grand Canyon, right? And I guess, you know, if it was an insurance company, it was probably like, you know, don't leave home without your insurance, otherwise you might fall off and need it, right? And in this big panoramic photo, way off in the distance, you know, panoramic view of the Eastern Grand Canyon, right in the distance of the photo, right in the middle of it, there's Butcher Butte, just sticking up, right?
Cool.
Front and center, right? And I had to put that in there into the materials, right? And so I corresponded a number of times with the board and kept following up with it, and eventually it succeeded. And I guess, you know, the park made a little bit of a special designation or a special case consideration because it was Harvey. And I pointed out that he had done more exploration than, you know, anybody that in the modern era, and was responsible for so much information about hiking routes and culture, you know, ancient culture and whatnot. And so, you know, they took all that and accepted it, and they finally designated the Butte, Butchered Butte, at some point, I think in the early 2000s. So,
That's cool.
it was a very satisfying experience because, you know, at that point I felt like I had honored my debt to my mentor. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And his family wrote me too, and they were very appreciative that I had done this, and so it was a very, very satisfying experience, and
yes.
I'm really glad I did it and stuck with it. You know, kept the tenacity up to deal with that park with the Park Service there.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Perseverance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So that was kind of a memorable trip for those reasons, and you know, but of course, I had a lot more to go. Right, we've got a lot more to go,
right,
Tom. You know, and I don't know. You know, you got to let me know if I'm going too much here. I mean, there's another trip in October, right? 96.
And what did you do
with
then?
Art? Yeah, Art and I decided to go down and do a big loop in Tuna,
okay.
Tuna Creek, and we wanted because you know it. A lot of, there's a number of summits that we could get there, and a lot of hiking and new routes that neither of us had done. So,
okay.
So, yeah, that was our next objective in October of 96. And we put our kit together and drove up to the North Rim and parked on the Point Sublime Road there, out a few miles short of Point Sublime, because we were going to come out of the canyon at Grandma Point, a different place than we went in.
Okay.
So I'm not sure how familiar you are with the route off of Point Sublime, but it's about Well, it's about a mile or mile and a half to the north of Point Sublime, on the west side of the plateau
Right.
there.
It gets you down to the Flint Tuna Saddle, I think, and then you can go out to Evans Butte if you want to go north northwest. You can go down Tuna, you can cross over to Crystal, come back up Crystal, and loop out that way.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's a great access point, you know,
yeah.
A great access point. And so, you know, by this time I definitely was looking at, I was ticking off the summits, right? And I have to say, I have to give credit here because I lived in Canada, right? And, you know, I would talk to Art and I'd say, it's time for a trip, you know, we got to go for a trip. And he would say, yeah, let's. How about October? And then he would think about what we were going to do, you know.
Okay.
And so a number of these trips were, you know, he put the thought into the logistics of the route, you know, getting his vehicle, you know, working with his vehicle, where we would park, you know. I mean, we both would look into reading Harvey's notes and studying the map, but Art, I have to say that Art quite often would be the germinator, right? He would be the one who would come up with the idea for the trip we were going to do. And of course, it was always a great idea, right? And because our hiking was quite equal, I think we both could handle anything the other wanted to do.
Yeah.
And even though Art's 4 years older than me, so you know he's always been in really great shape.
Yeah.
Anyways, you know, we decided to do this trip into the Tuna Creek area because there were a lot of neat things to check out there, right? And I had been down there in Tuna with Doug Ricard when he let me float down with his crew there the time they picked me up at Quaggan and dropped me off at Crystal, right? Well, they
right.
dropped me off at Tuna, actually, and then I went out Crystal. And so I had been down in Tuna, and Doug and I had hiked up it. But of course, hadn't connected with the rim yet.
Right.
And I've also been through the Flint Tuna Saddle in that long trip I took in the early 70s. And
I don't think you'd climbed Evans in the 70s.
No.
Right.
No, it was not until this 96 trip when I climbed Evans.
Right. And it's a fairly brushy journey down there to get over there. So were you thinking, okay, well, I'll climb Evans because I'm here at the saddle before we drop down Tuna going south. I'll basically go north, northeast, and over and climb Evans, and Art can wait for me.
No, this wasn't one of those Jim goes and Art waits behind. Jim, Art wanted to be very much involved in this, too. So,
okay.
So, yeah, he agreed, you know, that, you know, he understood my interest in the summits,
mm-hmm.
and he's just a superb hiker, right? And he, you know, he's, if it's a good hike, he'll do a summit, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he was up for this just as much. And so, so we worked our way down to the saddle there. And I think it was in the afternoon when we got to the saddle, and that was our campsite, right?
Mm, okay.
And one of the neat things was the descent, because through the Kaibab and the Coke, and there was the you work your way down through the Kaibab. There's some steep chutes. It takes some work to figure out the route,
uh-huh.
and then you get you do a little drop through the Torweep. There's several options there that are kind of like short climbs.
Yep.
The drop down, and then you contour along and you get down into the Coconino, and there's some, you know, really interesting work down through the ledges and whatnot, but it's all pretty straightforward. And then you get to this talus slope, and my God, there was a deer trail down that was just gorgeous, and it just switchbacked down this talus slope. I mean, it wasn't a constructed trail,
right,
of course, right?
And
these weren't switchbacks in the sense that we know them, right? But the deer, you know, would obviously move to the other side of the talus cone when, you know, it became more convenient, and because of their constant and numerous, repeated treks, you know, they had built a little trail, and it was just so neat to to be able to just walk down this trail through the Coconino. And it's not there now. I did it a couple of years ago, and it was much, much harder to find that trail. So,
oh, interesting.
Yeah. Huh. So, but anyways, I had that distinct memory from 96 of going down that. And so we camped in the saddle, and the next morning we hiked out to Evans Butte.
Okay.
And, you know, it's just a kind of a standard soup by Butte. Lots of fun, some scrambling here and there, you know, just enough to make it interesting. And I know you've done it.
You've
come up from the other side.
I came
from the
up
river,
from the
right?
river and came up from the river and got to the top and looked off toward Point Sublime and thought, oh, wow, this is basically a flat top butte here. I didn't have a map. I just crawled up from the river. And I thought, oh, well, then I wanted to come in at it from Sublime. I thought, well, this would be easy. I'll just drop down. I'll walk across this flat plain, you know. I looked over the edge and went, oh, this isn't quite what I was thinking here.
Mm-hmm.
It was great.
Yeah.
But it was brushy. I just remember coming at it from the east side. It was way brushier than it is coming at it from the river.
Yeah, for sure. And because you've got all that protection from the Supai Butte, you know, the ridge above you, right?
That's right. That's right.
And protection from the sun. And so it's cooler there, wetter, and definitely brushier. But it was, I mean, I don't remember it being anything problematic. I mean, not like the brush I'd...
Harvey had been out there and actually had left a little note in a little register out there.
Oh, yeah.
Did you find that?
On Evans?
Yeah.
I don't recall that, no.
Okay, I remember taking a photo of it.
Huh.
So, yeah, it was pretty fun.
Yeah. Well, it may be that, you know, we didn't actually see the actual register that he had because Evans is kind of flat, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I don't recall the cairn or the register or anything like that on the summit of Evans. I just remember walking around it and getting the great views.
Oh, yes, stunning.
And you know, Tom, I have to tell you, you know, your route up out of Hotauta up to Evans really fascinates me. I really want to do that at some point because it'd be a great line to connect. But you know, when I did when I did the river trip with Doug Ricard, where he picked me up at Phantom. And we went down to Temple Bar. I remember floating down the granite gorge there. It would have been probably, you know, just around Crystal somewhere, maybe downstream from Crystal a little ways, and looking up and seeing this summit, which from below looked just incredible, you know. And it's actually the Red Wall Massif that sits to the southwest of Evans Butte, and it's got some little Supai Buttes on the top.
That's Monadnock Amphitheater is right in there.
That's right, and so it would be the big massif that sits above the west side of Monadnock Amphitheater. And
that's right.
From this perspective of the river, oh no, I can see where it is now. It's around downstream from Turquoise. That's where you'd be looking straight up to the north and be looking up at this beautiful butte, you know, with these big fins of red wall coming down.
Yeah.
Anyways, I just really kind of fell in love with that butte.
Mm-hmm.
And and you're finding a route up from Hotauta up that Red Wall Amphitheater on the west side of that butte. It's really intrigued me, and so I really want to get back there and do that at some point.
It's easy. It's fun.
Okay, good. It's always nice to know that they're going to be straightforward.
Yeah.
Anyways, so we went out to Evans and you know, took in the views, and then we're coming back. And so here's where it got a little bit different, because we did split up, and I did pretty much all of the bumps on the Sagittarius Ridge.
Okay.
So just a couple of small ones. But there were some, you know, chimneys and things you had to climb up to get to the tops, and then I could follow along the top of the main portion of the ridge, the highest block of Supai, or ridge of Supai, and then got down off of that just before we descended down to the to our campsite, you know,
okay.
In the saddle.
Yep.
And so Art kind of went below while I worked my way along the top of the ridge, right, to kind of knock off as many summits as possible, right? They're not named, of course, this part of the ridge. So in any event, we got back down to the saddle then, and then we worked our way down through the Red Wall, and camped. If you go, have you been down that drop?
Yes.
To the Red Wall?
Yeah. Actually, came up from the river and went through there, and then went up to the saddle. I was hoping to get higher, but I was like getting late in the day, and I was just doing it as a day hike from the river. So I turned around and went back.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's the main fall in the Red Wall, and then there's another fall below that. I believe it's in the Precambrian, a fairly big one that you pass on the river east, river right, to the west of the bed. You work your way along the top of a sandstone, and then there's a break in the sandstone. You can get down. Anyways, we camped at the right above that that lower dry fall.
Okay.
It's below the Red Wall, but I think it's below the Red Wall, but certainly the lowest dry fall. And just right, I remember camping right on the lip of that. And so, you know, the next morning we continued then on down Tuna and had a fairly relaxing time, you know. And I have to say that this trip with Art contrasted so dramatically with the trip I took a couple of years ago into Tuna to climb Charybdis Butte, which was I did in May with my friend Mark Coleman, and we'll get to that eventually. But when we were here, Art and I in October, of course, it was quite mild and
right.
very relaxed. And so I remember the water in Tuna was a little it's salty down there.
Yeah.
When you get down into the Precambrian, there's some seeps and whatnot, but at least it's there. And so we camped down there, I believe, at the base of the Tapiz or just above in that area. And our plan was to do the next day, we were going to go down Tuna, work our way downriver, and then, the other way around. We're going to go along the Tonto at Tuna and then to the parachutist camp.
Yep.
And which is where, of course, you know, the World War II Air Force fellows had to parachute out of their plane, and they landed there, and it took some time before they were escorted out of the canyon, and the rescue party had to drop them supplies and whatnot.
That's
so
right.
We wanted to see that stuff, so we just walked around out there and found the site. It's not difficult. There was all sorts of trash still there,
right.
which is interesting when it's historical like that. It becomes more than garbage, right? Yeah,
it was garbage in 1945, and by 1995, at 50 years later, it needs to be preserved now. It's a historical artifact.
Yeah, and that reminds me another aside here in Nankoweap. It was just across from the big waterfall that's in the northwest arm of Nankoweap, above the Sieber Marion route.
Okay.
And I had gone in there. Maybe it was on the trip with Arden Bruce the previous spring, went into Nankoweap. Anyways, we had camped there high up in Nankoweap, and there was a big boulder. And there was obviously, it looked like there had been cowpokes there or something like that at one point. And there was some scratchings on the rock. And they were obviously very old. It's not like this had happened, had been done, 3 or 5 years or something like that. But somebody had drawn a picture of a male ejaculating, right?
Great.
On the rock, right?
Wow.
And I'm just thinking, today this is horribly offensive graffiti, but the fact that this was done by some cowpoke, or maybe it was, a member of Major Powell's crew or somebody like that, it has more of a historical significance.
So
right?
it wasn't contemporary, it was historic.
It was historic.
Oh,
I mean,
my gosh.
I felt that.
Huh.
I felt that way. Yeah.
Okay.
I felt that way.
Uh-huh.
And so I didn't, And because I felt that way, I kind of, laughed at it and took it with a grain of salt, right? And this is what guys do, at least some guys, let's put it that way.
Uh-huh.
And so, but again, it's a question of what becomes historical and what is just garbage. Right.
At what point does garbage become historical? Well, 50 years is the line.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and you know, I mean, you can see, like, my wife and I went to Pompeii a number of years ago, and there's all sorts of, you know, sexual, I won't say it's necessarily graffiti, it's a little bit more refined than graffiti, it's kind of like paintings and whatnot, that were on the frescoes, right, that were covered in the asphalt.
The asphalt, yeah.
And so, you know, again, it's another example where, you know, you get an insight into the Moors and cultures of the people who came before you.
That's right.
So,
that's right.
Yeah. So, anyways, that was a little aside.
It is interesting because there's a lot of there's canteens. I mean, there was at one point when we first got out there, would have been about that same time in the, well, maybe it would have been mid 1990s. Walking out there at one point, I found the rings from the parachute that one of those guys had laid out.
Oh, really?
And so there's some interesting stuff out there if you walk around. But riverers have been pulling stuff out of there since the late 40s.
Uh-huh.
Flare guns and radio sets and all kinds of junk.
Wow.
Those there were three guys out there, and they just got, they, the Air Force dumped a ton of stuff down to those guys to keep them going.
So, yeah.
Some of that's still there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we poked around for, I don't know, probably 45 minutes or something like that, and you know, satisfied ourselves with the stuff we could find. I remember finding a canteen, as you pointed out, but I don't remember flares or anything like that.
Those were gone. They were, yeah. Again, most of that stuff was taken away in the 40s, 40s uh-huh. and 50s.
Yeah, but, you know, very interesting place to be. And then, of course, you know, thinking about these guys down there and what were they thinking, you know? They're in the middle of, for them, they're in the middle of nowhere, right? And,
right.
I mean, for Art and I, we know where we are. We know what it takes to get out. Sure, it's a couple of day walk, but it's, you know, no big deal. We're down here for recreation. You know, they were down there as part of their job, and something went horribly wrong with their plane, and they forced a ditch, and I think it was in the night, wasn't it, when they ditched?
Yeah, there was that story. They were doing celestial navigation. This was a bomber squadron out of Tonopah. And the fatalities, the training fatalities in World War II were severe in these bomber training squadrons. Anyway, these guys were doing celestial navigation in the middle of the night. Pilot or co-pilot forgot to transfer fuel in the tanks from one to the other, and so the engines all quit. And so, you know, the pilot's flustered, and they're all training and learning, and I don't know, the engineer or something starts working this big pump to pump this fuel from A to B. And the pilot says, okay, everybody get out. And so these three guys jump out in the dark. And then the engines start because the air is turning the propellers of the engines. They're not running, but they're still, the props are still going round and round.
Yeah.
And suddenly there's fuel to the engines and the spark plugs are still firing. And boom, the engine starts. And the pilot's like, okay, here we go. And flies back to Tonopah.
Oh, I didn't know this story. This is great.
So there's three guys down there that are just on their parachutes, and they're watching the skyline, and they've been told, if you jump out at night, you watch the skyline, you've seen the lights, when the lights go out, get ready to hit the ground. So lights go out, they're ready to hit the ground, and they keep falling. and eventually they all hit the ground, and one guy broke his fibula, a little bone in his lower leg, which was stable in his boot, but it was painful. Anyway, the two guys finally found the third guy, but they didn't have any water. They tried to work their way down the river with a little raft that they built, but that really wasn't working very well for them, so they went back up. They crawled back up to basically where the one guy had set out his parachute, and it was hot, and they spent the night there, and they woke up in the morning, and they were just sitting there, just kind of twiddling their thumbs going, we're simply going to die here. And this big B-24 went over them and saw the parachute and circled back around and saw them there and then just came back with tons of stuff and just dropped water and a radio set and flare guns with instructions on which flares, you know, are you hurt, send one flare and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so this guy sent them a lot of food. So they had food and water, and they hung out there. And then Alan McRae found a way into them and hiked them out to the Northman. Yeah. It's quite
the story. I heard that was from Grandma Point. And I think that's what Butcher refers to in Grand Canyon Treks. He talks about how Alan McRae, was it with Merrill Club as well? I'm not sure.
It was with Club, but
was, okay, well, was McRae was certainly the opponent there. Yeah. And I think that Harvey's thinking was that that was the likely way out, that they went out Grandma Point.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, the other route that we came down via the Flint Tuna Saddle is equally...
Could have gone in that way.
Yeah, could have gone that way, too, although there are the falls, dry falls to negotiate. But, you know, coming up from below, it's not too problematic.
Right.
Anyways...
Right.
Yeah, has anybody ever written that story down?
Oh yeah, that's written. One of the guys had graduated from university, and his university did a great story on that. Afterwards, really nicely researched, and it's one of the best articles about that I've found.
Huh, neat.
I think I've got it electronically. I could email it to you if you want it.
Yeah, if you can, if you remember, you know, I can probably dig around and find it eventually, but it's always nice if you can just fly that stuff over to me here. So,
yeah.
Well, anyway, so yeah, we'd seen the parachutist camp, and I, you know, since reading Harvey's notes or books, I should say, the Treks books in the early 70s, I'd always wanted to go to this spot, right? And just to visit it, so it was a lot of fun, but we continued on our way and worked our way down to the bed of the drainage that is to the west of Tuna. It doesn't have a name, but it kind of comes down from Sagittarius Ridge there.
Right.
And we started.
So it's not called Scorpion Ridge. Maybe it is called Scorpion Ridge.
Yeah, Scorpion Ridge is just to the west of this drainage.
But you're going to see the east buttress, the red wall buttress of basically what is a big arc in the red wall.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get a sense that you could have climbed up through that red wall up that red wall nose there?
No, I did not get that sense. So have you done it?
Well, I attempted the western. You know, I think a scorpion has kind of a right and a left kind of front lead. And I came up the western lead and got about halfway up to the red wall, and then it just walled out.
Yeah, okay. Well, I looked at it, of course, because scorpion would be an obvious destination, right, for climbing. So I would have definitely been looking at that. What I thought might be an option for getting through the red wall was actually on the west side of Scorpion Ridge.
Yes.
Farther north towards Sagittarius Ridge, or you know, a fair ways north of that of the actual Scorpion.
Up from 104, kind of wannabe Ruby, want to be Ruby, regular Ruby, sort of area.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know the river miles. I mean, I'm sure you look at the map here and you know where every mile ticks off. But yeah, I'm talking. This is about a mile above Ruby. There's a drainage that comes down from the north side.
It's
actually coming from the east. So I thought there might be a way to get up that, and maybe you'll tell me there is.
I didn't see one, but we ended up there might be. But from 104, we ended up walking to top of the Tepetes south to where we could see there might be a break in the red wall. Walked up and looked at it and couldn't get through.
Okay.
Back. So, but you know, there's certainly you could do more exploring there.
Yeah. Well, on a later trip in the about 10 years ago, I guess, Art and Bruce and I went from Crystal down to Shinimo. And we hiked the Tepetes along through there, right?
Yeah.
And so I was very keen to try and get up Scorpion if we could, if I could. And, you know, from Tuna all the way around, I didn't think there was really any option.
I think that's right.
Until this drainage that's above I guess you're calling it 104.
Yeah.
And that year I did actually go up when we did that traverse there on the to Pete's,
okay,
along the Tonto. I did walk up that drainage and went up as far as I could, but I couldn't see any way through. So.
Okay. There may not be a way through until you get around to the Hotauda side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty solid red wall there,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. Okay.
So. Well, anyways, we went down Tuna. I'm sorry, down this drainage to the west of Tuna, and then worked our way up river.
Did you go down that drainage to the river?
Yeah.
Did you find any more artifacts in there?
No, I don't recall any artifacts for sure.
Because there's, you know, again, those guys were just bombed with stuff, and they were trying to throw stuff out to them, out the side doors of these, you know, large bombers. And if they didn't get their timing right, the stuff would undershoot them or overshoot them.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So stuff got scattered either side of where they actually set up their main camp.
Huh. So you found a lot of stuff in there then?
No, this is just what I've researched over years. I've only been to the main camp and walked around on the flats up there.
Uh-huh.
I haven't looked into that drainage to the west. But
right.
Yeah.
Well, I guess, you know, I have nothing in my notes about that, right?
Okay.
That we ran into anything. So,
so back up out of the west drainage, cross Tuna heading to Crystal. Then, on top of the Tapetes, or did you drop down? There's a break through the Tapetes that puts you right down almost to the mouth of Tuna at the river, off the Tonto there.
No, so from the parachutist camp, we went to the northwest.
Okay.
And went down into that drainage that comes down from Sagittarius Ridge.
Mm-hmm.
Followed
okay.
that downriver.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a dry fall in there that we had to work our way around. But then walked upriver to Tuna. And then from there we didn't go up to the Tonto. We went just followed the bed of Tuna all the way up.
Okay.
Yeah, that was our route. So I've got on my maps here a note that there's a route up from, I guess, like, is it Willie's Necktie Rapids?
Yes.
Up through the Tapetes there.
That's
pretty
right.
Pretty much, yeah.
That's right.
And, you know, you can kind of see it looks like it's a fault ravine or something.
Right. That's right.
So,
that's right.
Yeah. And but we didn't do that. You know, something to try. And, in fact, you know, I'm quite honestly, Tom, I'm sitting here staring at my Grand Canyon wall map, right,
mm-hmm.
to help me.
Yeah.
Let's talk about these things.
Yeah.
And here's another thing I've always wanted to do. I've wanted to go down to the north of Geike and Scylla.
Uh-huh.
There's a, on the map, it looks like a very obvious slope. It must be an obvious, you know, consistent slope that goes from the Tonto platform all the way down to the river. And so right at, I guess, at Willie's Necktie Rapids. And you could easily walk down that slope, right? And then if you had a way to cross the river, then you could cross and go up that break you're just referring to,
right,
on the north side,
right.
So that'd be a fun Trans Canyon route there, right? So
the current's pretty slick in there. Getting, I don't know about getting across the river. That might be
okay.
A little sporty, but
well, I defer to you on that.
And if you don't see an equal slope on the other side, I wouldn't try it, because it, a friend of ours just attempted to stay along the river from South Bass and stay along the river as much as they could, heading upstream, and right about in there, about 104, they just ended up getting cliffed out in a big way. And we're
yeah.
All right, well, I'm going to get up way up in the schist at the base of the Tapetes, and it's got in and out, and in and out, and in and out, and they just bailed on that and went up on the regular Tonto Trail.
Yeah. Actually, Art and I had done that when we did the Bass to Boucher. We had, in a series of day hikes from the Tonto, we'd gone down Ruby and Serpentine, and then we hiked up, you know, we hiked the stretches from Serpentine to Bass and from Ruby to Serpentine.
Right.
And then we hiked upstream from Ruby about a kilometer, as far as we could go.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, as you point out, you know, you can, sometimes you can go higher and then, you know, but it just gets dicier and dicier,
right? That's right.
So you cut your losses. So.
It's tough, and that's why people bail out up onto the Tonto and stay up on the big flat bench up there and walk around over there.
Yeah.
So you guys went back up to the Flint Tuna Saddle then?
Well, no, we went up Tuna Creek back to our camp. So this was all one day hike, right?
Got it. Okay.
So we were camped right around the Tapetes in Tuna, where the water
is. You left your packs there and then just day hiked out to the airman's camp and back.
Yeah, well, out to the airman's camp and then down this drainage to the west of Tuna, upriver to the mouth of Tuna, and then up Tuna back to our camp.
So upriver to the mouth of Tuna, that's quite a little scramble up there.
I have no recollection of that being difficult. Not nearly as bad. Yes, wait a minute. Now it is coming back to me. There was a stretch when we did this subsequently, Art and Bruce and I, on the trip I referred to a few minutes ago, where we had to get, and it was between Tuna and this downstream canyon, we had to get quite up, quite high up on the
schist
there. And it was kind of dicey. I remember that.
That whole section in there going from Tuna to Crystal isn't a lot of fun either. So
no.
It's, it's just slow going, and you got to pick your way along, and
Yeah, well, it's, but it's a fun place to be. That's
for sure. It's gorgeous. It's really pretty.
Yeah. So, anyways, we went back up to our camp. That was a long day. I remember that being a long day when we finally got into our camp, so we settled in, and then the next day was our exit day. No, I'm sorry. We still had another day after that. So the next day we wanted to get up onto the Supai because we were going to climb Confucius and Mencius. So we worked our way up the east arm of Tuna, heading towards Grandma Point.
Okay.
And so there's a red wall route that goes right about as far up Tuna as you can go, the east arm of Tuna. And then it's just a great little climb, just a steep talus slope basically, that takes you up to the top of the red wall. And along the way there, I went up each of the side canyons that came down to try and hike up to the amphitheaters at the base of the red wall. I like to go up into those places and just kind of sit there. It's like being in the Sistine Chapel sometimes when you have these huge pour-offs overhead, And you're just right up there against a 400-foot head wall, It's a pretty neat place to be.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's always the possibility that you're going to find a route that nobody else found before, right?
That's right.
So, eventually we did, we went to the red wall ascent, and I remember that we got up in like 28 minutes. It was like,
easy.
It was like we were in such great shape, and it was so straightforward that we could just zip up this thing.
Nice.
And so then we came back south and worked our way up through the Supai ledges to get onto the ridge that goes from Grandma Point out to Confucius and Mencius.
Okay.
And we camped up there on the Supai ridge. And the next day then went out on the ridge and climbed Confucius and Mencius temples. And have you done those?
I have not.
Oh, well, that's – the way to do that is not from the river. It's to do it from Grandma Point.
correct, yes.
Yeah. But the neat thing about both those climbs is that it's very interesting route finding, And the coolest thing for me – is that on both of them, I found reptile tracks.
Oh, fun.
On the slabs of Coconino.
Yeah.
And just very, very abundant reptile tracks.
Nice.
And, so cool to see those things out there because, of course, I'm a paleontologist.
Yeah.
And, we're talking about fingerprints of Anasazi on the Pueblos, and here we have, and then we're talking about, graffiti of the cowboys, and now we have the tracks of the vertebrates from 400 million years, well, not quite that old, but from a couple hundred million years ago. So, pretty neat succession of cultures there, biological evolution. So.
Very cool.
But, just a lot of fun to be out there. And I remember it was pretty cold. We had a cold snap, and it was very windy, and one of those days when, you could – the wind is just whipping around you, right, and really chilling us down. Mm-hmm. But just a lot of fun, and eventually then we got, we came back to our campsite and packed up, and then headed up the route up Grandma Point, and then back to the road. And I have this picture. I have on my computer screen, I have a couple hundred photos of the Grand Canyon that cycle through, on my desktop, right? And one of the images I have is a picture of Art walking the road, the Point Sublime Road, you know, heading back to his car. And it's just a gorgeous picture with the aspen, you know, all colored out.
Nice.
And the firs, you know, contrasting with the yellow and white of the aspen. And then, you know, very tall, right? It's a portrait shot. And then here's Art, you know, in his, white cap and white shirt and white pants and a blue or a green backpack walking down the road. Just a great, great photo,
nice.
You know,
well,
of the end
cool.
of the trip, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, just a really spectacular trip. I mean, you know, to see all this stuff at, you know, in one trip is just so exciting, right? So much fun to go trace down these old camps and see the history, you know,
uh-huh,
and then
uh-huh.
of course to do the climbing and the hiking, and well, you know what it's like. It's just a very satisfying feeling.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, no, it's fun. I will I'll go ahead this evening and copy that article and get that over to you. I think you'll really like that.
Oh, great, for sure. That'd be perfect. Yeah.
We've been going for a little over an hour now, and maybe
have
it's
we?
A good time to wrap up this this part of this interview, so sort of October of 1996. Is there anything else you'd like to bring into this hike before we wrap this up?
I can't recall anything particular, you know. I did mention earlier that there was a very distinct contrast between this hike, which we did in October, relatively cool, and the one I did in May of 2019 with Mark Coleman. So I'll touch base on that later when we get to it. But that's something to keep in mind, right? Because it was two totally different trips.
We got 20 years to go. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's going to be
yeah.
another, 40 hours. Huh?
Maybe. We'll see what happens. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, with that, then, this will conclude part 11 of Grand Canyon Oral History with Jim Haggart. Today is Sunday, April 25th, 2021. My name is Tom Martin. And Jim, thank you so very much.
Thank you for the opportunity, Tom.